Today Legends profiles creative leaders, and today we feature songwriter and singer Lee Greenwood. As a leader, perhaps you should think like a musician, creating a trusting voice, consistent and melodic. Here's the incomparable Lee Greenwood.
We saw him many years ago in the Miami area and just loved his songs and entire show. It was inspirational, entertaining, and made us feel very patriotic. Lee, welcome to our show.
Well, thanks for mentioning that, and I'm glad I got to perform for you, because we've been doing that for, I came to Nashville in 1980, so we've been touring as an artist for a long time, but my career did start in California. Born in Los Angeles, and then my parents, because my father was in World War II in the Navy, they were divorced, and I was moved to Sacramento, California, to be raised by my grandparents until such a time that my mother would remarry. And it was a good upbringing. We were farmers, if I kind of put it that way. We were sharecroppers, and there's a difference in owning land and not owning land. We had a little bit of land, but not much. And we had plenty of things to do to sustain our farm, from trees and bushes and things that I had to be constantly maintained, fruit trees a lot. As a kid, I can remember actually selling flowers and fruit to the local Chinese market in order to make money for my own clothes, and that was an interesting beginning as a entrepreneur. But I had music in my life from the very beginning. My mother was a piano player in the 40s, and so I had a piano in our trailer where we were living, and I would play it every single night if I was allowed to. And generally, my grandmother would let me sit and play even into the dark, because we turned the lights out so it would save electricity, and I could actually play in the dark until I learned to play more by ear than by music. That would benefit me somewhat, but I had my own band by the time I was 13, 14 years old. I spent 1 year in Anaheim High School as a ninth grader when my mother had remarried someone who would build motels and hotels at the Disneyland area. But that only lasted a year for me. They sent me back to Sacramento to finish my school, and that's where I really began to develop in music. And I left home at the age of 17 years old and went straight to Nevada to begin my tenure as a working musician artist.
Well, that's impressive. Hey, tell us about your start in the First Baptist Church as a soprano.
Yes, I am a Christian. And much to my regret, my grandparents were not religious. They may have been, but they didn't let me know that. But they did make sure that I went to church, even if they didn't take me to church. We generally had a Wednesday night, which was a fellowship gathering and a rehearsal for the choir. And I would sing with the choir normally on a Sunday if I wasn't either working with my own band on a Saturday night and I was sleeping in, and that happened a lot. But it was a great experience for me to sing in the church, because I think that was really good for my ear training, and I had such a high voice, and I still do, that I was actually singing with the soprano section in the choir, and it wasn't too far from my house, so I could actually ride my bicycle back and forth. It was a great experience, and I took my wife Kim back to Sacramento when I had a show there, and we visited my old neighborhood in North Sacramento on Rio Linda Boulevard, and we visited the church, and it's still there, and it has changed now to a Spanish church, like a Pentecostal church, and we actually were there on a Sunday night, and we went in and watched the service, and of course it was exactly as I remember it. The first time I sang Oh Holy Night was there at that altar, and that was pretty scary for me as a 13-year-old.
You know, but it's moments like that that really build character. Lee, we also read that you had this first band called the Apollos. Share some fond memories of being in that band.
Yeah, it was actually plural, the Apollos. Apollo is a Greek god, and so we figured, I guess we're all Greek gods. I don't know how that developed, but I was 15 and everybody in the band was much older. My guitar player was a Sears salesman, and the drummer was a Porsche racing driver. We had another sax player in the group who was Filipino. I loved him to death. His name was Goody Javiar, and that was all he did was play music. So it was interesting, you know, putting the group together, because I was so far ahead musically of anybody in the band, even at my very young age. I mean, I was already playing in nightclubs. I played sax and piano, and I still do. And so I would arrange music and teach it to the band, and then we'd play that. I was the focal point of what we would call a show band in those days, because we played every kind of thing, from Broadway music to rock to country and gospel. So it was kind of a mixed match of stuff. But it took us all the way to Vegas, because when I left high school, the day I graduated, I didn't even go through graduation ceremonies. I just ran to Reno. And we played, we opened at the Golden Hotel in Reno with that band, the Apollos. And then I would eventually take that whole group to Vegas. And we would open at the Stardust Hotel in 1961 with the band, the Apollos. And I would work a year there before I finally disbanded the group and left and stayed as a working musician in Vegas.
Well, along your career path, you must have drawn from other musicians and their rhythms. Share a story or two about them.
You know, as you say that, I don't believe I had a musical mentor. I really drew upon an awful lot of music around me, and every group that I would join, I would absorb the information. I would apply myself to learning from the group, whether it was a great piano player named George Hernandez, who came and played piano with the Apollos at the Stardust, taught me a lot of Cuban rhythms. I had a karate teacher who played bass with a group called the Novelites when I was the piano conductor for them. They were 30 times on the Ed Sullivan Show, and I became part of the band at the same hotel that I actually started at, the Stardust, in, I think it was 1970. And so that bass player taught me a lot of discipline in my personal life, as well as I was learning to orchestrate for a vocal group and play piano with them. And so as a background musician, I always would absorb, you know, and try to learn more from the groups I was working with. Now, having said that, there's a lot of people that I would listen to and sort of make myself play like them. And I think before anyone has a hit of their own, they tend to mimic other people. And I did that a little bit, but with my own style. So I would listen to sax players like Illinois Jacquet and Earl Bostic and the Dorsey brothers. Jimmy Dorsey was a great sax player, and his brother played trombone. And I would listen to those musicians. Sam Butera, who played with Louis Prima, Sam Butera and the Witnesses, was extremely impressive to me, and I picked up a lot of that. As far as singers go, we would go all the way back to Sam Cooke, who I loved the style of Sam Cooke. Peeble Bryson, because of the kind of singer he was, an amazing singer. But I would listen to people like Kenny Rogers, and who became a close friend of mine later in my career, and I even wrote a hit song for him after I came to Nashville. So it was a combination of things, you know, from singers to musicians, and I was just constantly growing and constantly, you know, and reinventing myself while I was there.
We have a theory about your songwriting. Are your songs a reflection of your core values, patriotism, and maybe even trauma that you experienced in life?
In some respects. I mean, we're just going to point out God Bless the USA is the only patriotic song. I mean, there's another one called The Great Defenders that's on my American Patriot album.
You got it.
I recorded. But other than that, I'm a romantic, and having been married much too soon in my life and having children much too soon, a writer, no matter what kind of music they write or what genre they write in, you're going to have to go through some pain and some hardships. And I think that's the thing that benefited me the most, because there was a lot of that, from broken marriages to lost romance. And I think that's what pours out of a writer, and certainly did with me, with some of the songs that I've written. God Bless USA, setting that apart from all of the others that I've ever written, really was a reflect upon the fact that being born in California in a time in the 40s when America was struggling, I think I probably, the first line of the song, "If tomorrow the things were gone, I'd work for all my life," that was about my grandparents and how hard they worked. So seeing the pain in other people as well tends to help a writer, I believe, write the words. And of course, I worked the music as well, because I was a drum major from a high school band, and those marches kind of always stuck in my head. So you put all that together, and that's where you got that song. But if you listen to some of the other things I've written, they're more of a romantic nature, and they do show pain and hardship.
Well, indeed it does. Out of curiosity, what was the most meaningful single performance of God Bless the USA?
It would be hard to single one out. There have been so many. As you know, USA has been penned as the most recognizable patriotic song in America, so I've sang it in so many different places that were important, certainly at the White House for two different presidents, on an aircraft carrier, the Nimitz, out on the Mediterranean, at the Sailors and Soldiers Old Folks Home in New York. It's hard to say, you know, probably if one stood out more than anywhere, only because of the impact it had on me, was after 9/11 at Yankee Stadium when I sang for the Firemen's Memorial. And there was Bette Midler sang Wind Beneath My Wings, Mark Anthony sang America the Beautiful, and I sang, America, and I sang God Bless USA. I would say, given all of that, and I've sang for five presidents twice in the same location at the same time, but having to do that one performance at Yankee Stadium, and that wasn't my last appearance there, but that moment is so indelible in my mind that I'll never forget that one, and it probably stands out as the most important one I've ever done.
Well, like yourself, we're big fans of President Reagan, and before the pandemic, maybe we'll call that BP, we visited his presidential library for the third time. We know that you sang at the opening of that library. Tell us about that moment.
Yeah, I'm a Reaganite, and he was the first president I had worked for and with, very closely, by the way. I had met President Nixon when I was a band director in Sacramento. He had made his vice president, he made a visit to the city, and I was standing next to the airplane when he stepped off and shook my hand, and that was the first time I'd ever met anybody with any power, political power. But working with Ronald Reagan and becoming Nancy Reagan's champion at many of the events that we played, I already had friends on the dais behind me. But Johnny Grant, who was the former mayor of Hollywood, was the one that petitioned me to sing God Bless USA as the five presidents and six first ladies are sitting behind me. And he said, I would like you to have them stand up at a point in your song when you're singing that line. And I said, well, that's going to be very difficult. First of all, it's Ronald Reagan's day, but George Bush, 41, who was vice president when I met him at the White House, is now president. And so it was an interesting dynamic, because behind me was Presidents Nixon, Carter, and Ford. So you have three Republicans, two Democrats, and their wives, and they're on display. I mean, it's in the hot sun. There's, well, not terribly hot, I guess. It was fairly good temperature. We all had suits on, and a myriad of cameras, and they had four jets waiting in Simi Valley. If the president stand up, they were going to fly over the top, and that would be the camera shot. And so I proceeded to sing, and with the track playing, and I'm looking down the line of presidents, I'm moving back and forth so the cameras can get good shots of all of the presidents in their expression, and and so when it comes to the part in my song where I gladly stand up next to you, I think President Reagan probably was briefed, because normally as an actor he doesn't engage with people very long. He was a little aloof, and he'd make you feel good, move on to the next person. But I could just sense at that moment he looked straight at me, and he's going to stand up. So when he did, his friend George Bush, former vice president, now president, stands up. the crowd has to all stand up, including all of the presidents behind me, and here come the four jets flying directly overhead. So it was a moment that, you know, looking at the Reagan Library, going inside, and I've been there three times, as you have, with Air Force One that I flew on several times, inside the building. It was terrific. And I've been there twice, 20 years later, when Nancy was still alive.
Well, Lee, thank you for that. And on Saturday, we went over to the Bush Library in College Station and paid homage to number 41 and Barbara Bush, our very favorite First Lady. It was great to get out again and have a little normalcy again. To that point, Lee, would you please provide an encouraging word to our audience, especially our American audience that happens to love you, about hitting the restart button?
Well, thank you for letting me address the nation that way. I'm a simple farm kid, walking in high cotton most of the time, married to a beautiful wife, and if I have to be quarantined, that's the best scenario, you know, to have this wonderful woman next to me. My two sons are both in college. I would not be afforded that unless I had a country where I could make my own living and work when I want to. And not since I was 12 have I been told I cannot work. It has to be extremely frustrating for those people who have been furloughed or lost a job because of the shutdown over the pandemic. I'm not only sympathetic, I'm almost angry for the fact that we have had such a horrendous pandemic hit us and affect us economically. Because after 2001 and the attack on America, we all could hug each other in grief and share our feelings and emotions. In this pandemic, we cannot. And we're people standing apart, and the people in my neighborhood, when I drive by, I wave at them and they wave back, but we can't touch. So it's kind of a common thing, like saying, it's okay, we're waving at each other, we're going to get over this. And you've heard the phrase several times, we're in this together. Well, let me tell you, we're all in this together, the entire world. So, you know, I'm counting on the president and the administration to make the right decisions. I know they've done their best so far under these extreme circumstances. But hang in there, everybody. This is going to come back, and when it comes back, it's going to come back with a roar. And we'll put this behind us, just like the cholera, the Spanish flu. The regular flu is just as bad to catch if you ever get that. And my sympathies go to families who have lost someone to this COVID-19. But it'll be behind us, and we'll move on, and America will be back.
Well, thank you, Lee Greenwood. That means so much. So where can we find out about your upcoming events?
Well, first of all, I'll mention that Memorial Day, I'm doing a virtual performance, Facebook Live, to be carried by several different networks, including the NRA and the network out of Branson, RFD. And so we're going to do an hour and a half show. So if people would come in, you know, just join us on that site. We'll have a display on the screen to go to my website, which is LeeGreenwood.com. And there'll be donation, because we're actually going to take donations for Helping a Hero, which is my charity that I support out of Houston, Texas. We build homes for wounded warriors. So beyond that, it's going to be hopefully an upbeat and positive thing and a tribute to our military. So go to LeeGreenwood.com. You'll find out about the performance, Memorial Day, May 25th. And then throughout the rest of the year, as we begin to put our dates back on that are all canceled right into July, hopefully we'll get to work July, August, and we can be out entertaining and give people confidence again.
Lee, you are truly emblematic of best versions. Thank you so much for being on our Success Made to Last show today.
Thanks, Rick, and thanks for the interview.
Graceful Years is America's favorite encouragement greeting card company. When you need encouragement, prayers, thank you, and oh yeah, to celebrate events like birthdays and anniversaries, this is the greatest greeting card company around. You can get it all at gracefully-years.com today. And you know, while you spend $3 to $4 per individual card that you may buy at a Walmart, a Walgreens, a CVS, a Cost Plus World Market, and maybe even buying cards for $1 or $1.50 at dollar stores, Graceful Years cards can be purchased in their artsy collection of 12 cards. This is their box cards. That'll cost you less than 75 cents per card. And top it off with, those are delivered to your home, your office, your church, your company, wherever, with free shipping. You just can't beat the quality, the value. There are 50-some-odd wonderful fine artists that are all a part of the Gracefully Yours collection. So support Gracefully Yours today. Go to gracefully-yours.com today and support that company. And if you want to get your cards at an extra discount through Success Made to Last, you can put in the promotion code BOOK3 today. That's B-O-O-K-3 and get 25% off your total purchase.